What's up, independent insurance agents? Are you finally fed up with the massive amounts of time, money, resources being allocated to customer service within your agency? Is this causing your agency growth and revenue to become stagnant or even decline? The answer to this frustration is Glovebox, the premier mobile and web self-servicing solution made by successful independent insurance agents just like us, specifically for independent insurance agencies. Guys, this is the only platform with direct carrier connections. Glovebox gives your clients the power to engage within their writing carriers and you, their agency, in a single, easy-to-use platform. Mention the Insurance Guys podcast and get 20% off of your monthly subscription for life, guys, for life. This isn't an intro deal. This is for life. Schedule your demo with Glovebox today. Thanks.
Insurance agents from around the world, welcome to the Insurance Guys podcast. My name is Scott Howell, your fearless host and leader, insurance agency owner and insurance evangelist for iProtect Insurance and Financial Services, based out of Huntsville, Alabama. And before we get started on today's episode, please help me welcome. He is a 6'3" sophomore from Sarah Land, Alabama. Parade first team All-American, Rivals five-star recruit. He is a fantastic insurance agent and a great American. Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together and welcome the incomparable Mr. Bradley Flowers. How are you, Bradley?
Great, Scott. How are you today?
I'm the best I have ever been. Hey, I forgot to do it again, so let me say it. The Insurance Guys podcast, powered by Glovebox. There you go. There it is right there. That's how I need to say that. Bradley, today might be the greatest insurance podcast that has ever been produced in the history of the world since baby Jesus walked on earth, because this is one of the topics that is the most controversial and probably least talked about from a day-to-day perspective in the insurance business. And guys, I have got great news for you. For all of you agents out there that are looking forward to suing Scott Howell when he hires your best producer because you pay them in Kohl's bucks and Halloween Snickers, and Scott takes them from you, and you're going to have to send Scott the letter, the cease and desist, copy your attorney. Today is your day, guys. We will go ahead and give my labor attorney's email out, and we can just cut out the middleman today, and you can send all that straight to her, and we can just cut out the middleman on you having to send anything directly to my house.
I'm laughing at the thought of the stress that must come with being Scott Howell's counsel in any sense of the word, in any way. I'm laughing at that.
I have today's guest on speed dial. We talk quite regularly. And
you get sued often.
Hey, Bradley, no joke, though. I mean, let's just call it what it is. You're actually one for one on this yourself. I mean, you've hired one great producer with loads of experience, and you got the letter.
Technically, I'm two for two if you count myself.
Bradley's two for two, guys. He's two for two. But
That's two challenges and two wins.
That's right. Two for two. Hey, guys, we are excited. We are proud. We are humbled to be here today. As I always like to say, our mission on this podcast is to help you agents any way we can. The topic of conversation today, guys, is we're going to talk about employment agreements. We're going to talk about non-competes. It is one of those questions that you see on Facebook pages for insurance agents that pops up from time to time. And every time this question pops up, there's like 465 comments that range from people not knowing what in the hell they're talking about to some that do know what they're talking about. So
what I love are the people that are just so confident in their answer. Right. And anybody who has half a brain can be like, well, that dude is wrong. But he is so far from knowing that he's wrong or thinking that he's wrong. It's just, there's no way, there's no point in even arguing.
Exactly. Don't even respond. That's exactly right.
Yeah, those are my favorites.
So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to bring on our guest today and give her the introduction that she has always deserved. Ladies and gentlemen, she is originally from Pensacola, Florida, and she currently resides in Birmingham, Alabama. She received both her undergraduate and Juris Doctorate, might I add, magnum cum laude, from the University of Alabama in 2000. She is married to the ruggedly handsome Steve, and they have one beautiful daughter named Libby. She currently serves as a partner with Scott Dukes and Geisler PC in Birmingham, Alabama, and she specializes in providing employment advice, alleged malpractice, EEO training, and policy review to companies across a wide range of industries. She appears before administrative agencies in both state and federal courts. She has been named Top 40 Under 40 by the Birmingham Business Journal, Law Dragon 500, U.S. Corporate Employment Lawyer, Best Lawyers in America. She's named a Super Lawyer, Rising Star, Alabama Super Lawyers. It is my profound honor today to introduce to you my labor attorney and my friend, first-time guest on the Insurance Guys podcast, Ms. Kim Geisler. How are you, Kim?
Hey, I'm really happy to be here. I have to say that was the best introduction I think I've ever gotten. Strong.
For a nominal fee, I'll follow you all over Birmingham, and before you come into a room, I will introduce you.
I know. Well, you know, if people see me in person, you're probably going to have to drop that top 40 under 40. They start trying to figure out how long ago that was.
Hey, that's a big deal, though, because I remember when I lived in Birmingham, that was a big issue of the Birmingham Business Journal, and I realize it was a few years ago, but that's still a pretty damn big deal. There's been a lot of very successful people appear on the top 40 under 40 in the Birmingham Business Journal.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here. And you're right. It's a really hot issue. And it's a really big deal for employees that are looking to move, for employers looking to hire folks that have these types of agreements. And I'm guessing one of the things that you have seen in those Facebook comments you referred to is what I hear really frequently, which is, oh yeah, I signed that, but they're not enforceable.
Correct.
So, you know, the question I usually ask someone says that is, well, who did you talk to? And a lot of times it's, you know, my new boss or my sister, my accountant, my divorce lawyer. And most of the time it's not an employment lawyer.
Right.
So it's a very different story when you talk to an employment lawyer, because the first sentence of the story is usually as far as anyone reads, which is that contracts that restrain trade, like something that would tell you you can't work in your industry or you can't call on certain clients. The first sentence is that contracts that restrain trade are void. But what you have to do is keep reading, because then there's the big unless. Mm-hmm. And that's where the details really matter.
Right. So here's the first thing I'm going to say. And Kim, I need you to back me up on this. I will assume that every state has some nuance and some difference, and some states are probably more aggressive in the state Supreme Court upholding non-competes or the courts. And then other states may be a little bit more lenient. I have heard, and you can tell me if I'm right or not about this, but I've heard that the state of Alabama's Supreme Court, in their opinion, has basically said this, and I am paraphrasing, we do not like non-competes, but we are a pro-business state in Alabama, and we are going to uphold them.
That's right. I mean, that is...
Within reason.
Yeah, I would say that is a fairly accurate statement. There is a statute in Alabama that has been amended as of 2016 that tries to give people a little more guidance in terms of what to expect,
right,
in terms of what is enforceable and what is, quote, reasonable. Particularly, the focus is on the time frames for these. But going back to your first point, you know, state to state, there's a lot of variation. I mean, I have clients all over the country, and one of the things that they want to do for convenience is, like, can we just have one agreement? And, you know, more often than not, the answer to that is no, or at least not with a certainty that it'll be enforced the same way everywhere you go. As you can imagine, just by reputation alone, California is not enforcing a non-compete in the same way Alabama would enforce a non-compete.
Correct.
So jumping into sort of what makes them enforceable on the front end, You know, you have to have a protectable interest. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? Because that's definitely a lawyer sounding phrase. And what I think it means for insurance folks are two things. You have to have confidential information that you're trying to protect with the agreement. And that can be a whole host of things. Doesn't have to rise to the level of a quote trade secret, like nobody can know it, nobody can figure it out.
Right.
Not that level, but at least that you treat the information confidential and it's not publicly known within your industry. So sometimes that'll be, you know, the pricing info that you're using with your clients. Sometimes it'll be the customer lists. Sometimes it's business model for your particular business. Mm-hmm. That type of information can be a protectable interest to support a non-compete or a non-solicit. And then probably the most important thing that's protectable that you can see from your personalities is the relationships. The relationships between the insurance agent producer and the folks they work with, and the reason they keep coming back to you, Scott, is because they like you. And so you have protecting the relationships that you have with those folks would probably qualify as a protectable interest.
Right. So let's get into some examples here. I don't want everybody to get into legal speak and fall asleep on us. I want to get into some examples that I will use. So of the many potential lawsuits that we look at in our office, we have actually, without giving details, run into this trade secret stuff, right? We've had one of those in the past year. And that was, to me, very ambiguous in terms of, well, what is a damn trade secret? Is your customer list a trade secret? Is, do you remember this, what we kind of went through?
Yeah, I know. I know exactly what you're referring to. And that's where I think that the ability to enforce the non-compete, you don't have to be dealing with something that rises to the level of trade secret.
Right.
Now,
it doesn't have to be Coca-Cola's secret formula for Coke.
Yeah, or the KFC, right, you know, recipe. I mean, those are the things you most often think of as, quote, trade secrets. Mm-hmm. The reason lawyers like to get to trade secrets is because the trade secret statute has some bigger damages available to it. Mm-hmm. And also gives you an avenue for attorney's fees. And right, most of the time, your non-compete will have a prevailing party. If you win, you get your attorney's fees, but sometimes they don't. And so right, the trade secret statute, if you have a lawyer who dropped the ball on an attorney's fees provision in an employment agreement, the trade secret statute is a way to kind of backdoor in getting your fees.
It's a catch-all.
Mm-hmm. And so, but trade secrets, as you suggested, are very difficult to establish.
Right.
Because really it does mean that it's not something that with a little effort you could figure out.
Right. Right.
Whereas confidential information is sort of a little bit lower bar. If you were willing to spend 2 weeks, you know, mining through documents to figure out how to put together this compilation, it probably wouldn't be a trade secret, but it might be confidential information.
Right. Here's my next question. And all I do is think like the 250,000 insurance agents that are listening to this right now. So I'm an insurance agent in Indiana, for instance, or Washington State, or Wyoming, or Boston, Massachusetts right now, or even in the deep south down in Florida. Across the entire United States of America, what is a pretty standard time frame in terms of how long someone can't call on that book of business after they leave?
100 years.
And then distance as well. You know, you can't say somebody can't work for 10 years and they can't sell insurance except in the state of Alaska and Puerto Rico, right? You can't do that. That's not reasonable. But across the country, the entire U.S., what is a fairly reasonable time and distance?
Well, you know, the lawyer's favorite two words in the world are, it depends.
Right.
You know, what determines geography and temporal limitation is what is necessary for the protectable interest. So to your point, Scott, if you've never called on anybody in Florida, you're not going to restrict anyone who works from you from going to work in Florida. If you do not have a branch doing business in a state where you're trying to restrain someone, you're going to be hard pressed to enforce a non-compete in that state.
Right.
The shorter the temporal restriction, the better chance you have it being broader geography-wise. Alabama did step in with the statute and try and set some, quote, presumptively reasonable time periods. What is really funny is they kind of make no sense when all read together.
Right.
The presumptively reasonable time period in Alabama under the statute for a non-compete, which is means, you know, you can't work at all in your industry for whatever they've defined the geographic area, is 2 years.
Okay.
Now, here's where it gets weird. The presumptively reasonable restricted period for a non-solicit, which means you can be working, you just can't call on your specific clients, is 18 months. So, you know, the lawyers that read the statute after it was put out were sort of confused. Why could a restraint that's more restrictive have a longer presumptively reasonable time period than just saying don't call on your clients?
Right.
And then it even gets more strange because one of the other type of restrictive covenants that comes into play, and I really hope that you have this experience one day, is, you know, when somebody comes in and buys your business.
Oh, I will. Don't worry. I will.
Somebody comes in and buys your business for, you know, $5 or $10 or $20 million.
Right.
And they don't want you to immediately open up a new business, right? Competing with them.
Right.
So one of the types of restraints that you see in these non-competes or restrictive covenants is, I bought your business, you can't do this business around me for a period of time. Mm-hmm. And so the statute says the presumptively reasonable time period for that type of restriction, the purchase of the goodwill of a business, is 1 year, which again, to lawyers and I think even lay people, makes zero sense. If you pay me $20 million, I'm happy to sit at home for 2 or 3 or 5 years.
Right.
But you know, if you're paying me $50,000 a year and then you're telling me I can't work for 2 years after, that seems far more harsh
and
penalizing than somebody who sold their business. But it is the way it's written.
Are you saying that there's really no distance? If I make somebody in my office sign a non-compete, could I say you can't work within a 400-mile radius and that be considered okay?
Well, here's the thing. The distance is tied to what is reasonable and what is protectable. And what's funny is the statute only speaks to, it has to be somewhere where you are actively engaged in business.
Got you.
Like I said, can't restrict somebody outside of Alabama if you don't do work or call on people outside of Alabama.
Got you.
But what happens is the courts will look at how does that geographic restriction look for that particular business?
Right.
And the best example I have for this is, you know, the Head Start, the haircut place.
Right.
There's one like everywhere. So they had a restriction in their non-compete that was, I think, 5 miles. Now, anybody reading that on its face would say, oh, surely to goodness, 5 miles has got to be reasonable.
Right.
But that case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. Or maybe it was the Court of Civil Appeals. That might have been where they stopped. But anyway, the court said, no, it wasn't. Because when they looked at all of the Head Starts, because it was within 5 miles of any Head Start, when they mapped out all the Head Starts, this covered like all these different areas in spanning multiple states. Because there are Head Starts everywhere.
Right.
So what it boiled back down to ultimately is they said, where did she actually work? Mm-hmm. And that particular location became the base. And then they worked out from there.
Got you. So you said something to me that was probably one of the most poignant things I have ever heard in my entire life. And it really sits at the basis of why I get sued so much or threatened to be sued. Our agency only hires extremely good agents who are extremely experienced and have been doing this a long time. And we were on a call, I guess it's been about a month ago, and you're like, well, the one thing you have to realize, Scott, is the better you are, and this doesn't matter what industry that you're in, but the better you are at your job and what you do, and the more revenue that you bring in, the chances of your current employer trying to hinder you from going and doing something else somewhere else with somebody else goes up astronomically.
That's exactly true. And that's just good business sense, because I'll tell you, the thing that is different about non-compete litigation, and probably the reason, you know, there's a lot of letter writing before people jump into it, is most lawsuits span 12, 18, 24 months. And people who retain a lawyer to sue somebody, a company that retains a lawyer to sue somebody in just a regular business dispute, they can spread over all that time their legal bills. They can, the demands on their time, you know, for doing discovery and showing up to stuff is all spread out. When you're involved in non-compete litigation, you take that 12, 18, 24 month window and it gets squished down to probably 30 days. Because once you are successful in getting a temporary restraint on an employee, a former employee, that can't stand under the law, but for a very limited period of time. 2 weeks, basically. And so you have to be ready to go to put on your case on why it should extend longer at the end of that 2 week period.
Right.
And companies, this going back to your point about being a top producer or being valuable, a company is not going to want to shell out $50,000, $60,000, $75,000 and put everybody in their department on a lawsuit in a 30-day period unless there is something significant being lost.
Right.
And the other reason, too, I say that employers are hesitant to do this, to pursue this on every level, is because to make your case for damages, you know, you do have to show what you lost. So if you've got kind of a deadbeat person in your office and they've never brought in a client and they don't have a book of business and they leave you, you know, you're spending a whole lot of money to not have a potential return of very much of anything.
Right. Is there an industry that you represent? Because you go across a wide array of industries. I've always said that I don't know of an industry in terms of strictly the non-compete agreement, compliance, I'm going to sue you, you know, the whole thing that we always go through. I've never seen an industry that is as litigious about non-competes as the insurance industry. Is there any other industry out there that's even holds a candle to the insurance industry?
Probably not. I mean, I do have work with other businesses, but they're pretty varied. I think the thing that makes insurance probably unique is because, you know, you do build these relationships and there's no doubt about that. And you are insurance agents with good relationships and good big books of business are really, really marketable and in demand. And you know, that may not necessarily be true in every industry where somebody does sales. It may not always translate to another company. So, I mean, if you're a fantastic, you know, if you're doing fantastic sales of Coke products, they may not see you as really being able to come in and do fantastic sales of Pepsi products, even right. if you got the good skills.
Right.
That kind of thing.
So help me out here, and then I want to move on to a subset of this topic. For all the insurance agents listening to this right now, and especially associate agents that have signed non-compete agreements, let's start with them. The people who have signed non-compete agreements in agencies like mine and Bradley Flowers all over the U.S., we're going to talk in blanket statement here. What advice would you give them in terms of what they should do prior to their first day of working? And that's another question I need to ask you off after this. Before they sign that non-compete agreement, the producer, the person that's signing it, what advice would you give them before they sign it?
As in all things, you know, negotiating your salary, negotiating your benefit package, certainly before you sign the non-compete, you've got a lot more leverage before you sign. And certainly before you start looking to leave, okay?
Right.
I would say, because things do vary state by state, I would say have a lawyer in your particular state, spend the $250, $350, whatever the current going rate is for a lawyer in your state, to spend an hour looking at it and seeing if you have some leeway on the front end. I doubt very seriously you'll be able to say, I refuse to sign it. Not if you want right. to work there.
Right.
But if there is some rephrasing that can be done that would put you in a better position when it is time to leave.
Okay. So next question.
Mm-hmm.
For all of the employers, the agency owners who are listening to this right now, in terms of putting together a non-compete agreement, what advice would you give them? And before you answer that, my understanding was when they updated the Alabama code, and I believe you said 2016, they have also made it a point to say something about the non-compete agreement needs to be signed on the date of the employment starts, not 2, 3, 4 weeks before they start. Have you heard something like that?
That actually predates the statute, but to this point, we haven't heard that pre-existing law has been changed
yeah.
because the statute talks about agreements between employees, agents. And so the presumption is you are in the relationship on the date the agreement is signed. And the statute does make clear, too, that the agreement does need to be signed by both the employer and the employee.
Correct.
And I think the amendment of the statute, it might have been a little loose on if the employer failed to sign.
Right.
But yeah, the employment relationship needs to be in existence on the time you sign, not before you start to work.
Right. And then to those insurance agency owners, independent and captive owners, that are putting together an employment agreement, their non-compete that they're going to have their agents sign, what advice would you give them?
Well, I think more so than any other type of agreement, you don't want to do this like Google search on best employment agreement, best non-compete, and just like print it off.
Noncompeteagreements.com.
Yeah. You know, you want to consult with a lawyer that is local to you. Okay. There are a lot of national firms now that have offices in every state, but, you know, consult with a lawyer that practices in the state where you are working, and just have them guide you on the non-compete, because it's a big thing to invest in for your company to be disappointed when you want to enforce it, that right. it wasn't right. And in a little bit of time and money on the front end mm-hmm. Is going to put you in the best position.
Let me ask you a question on mm-hmm. my situation. When I was an employee, and we're past the 2 years, so I'm assuming I can talk about this. You know, the company I was at would pay when you left, as long as the non-compete was not violated, they would pay you a percentage of your commission for a particular product for so many years. Okay. So I left and started Portal. I got and of course I was worried about the non-compete, and we were, you know, trying to navigate those waters and that sort of thing. And I got a letter in the mail, I want to say 6 months after I left, and I'd gotten 6 months of payments. that said, hey, basically it said, hey, we've determined that you violated your non-compete. Here's why. Since you violated your non-compete, we are not paying you these payments anymore, which I took as a good thing. And this is my question. I took as a good thing because I was like, okay, that's them saying, this is what we're doing since you violated your non-compete. And okay, we're good. And that would not have been viewed well if they decided 8 months after that to go back and sue me for the same thing. Does that make sense?
Or worse.
Almost like a double jeopardy kind of thing. It's like, wait a minute, this was the punishment. And then the letter said nothing else about potential for anything else.
Yeah, I do see what you're saying. And I haven't looked at the specific agreement, but there's the carrot and the stick approach, right? So some agreements, you see them less often, but it sounds like that was your agreement, Bradley, are the carrot. And I think some places refer to them as garden leave provisions. Garden leave meaning I'll pay you to sit around and piddle in your garden for this period of time as opposed to competing against me. So if the agreement was worded as such, you get these payments so long as, and then, you know, they referred to your alleged violation and said, this is now why we're stopping the payments. That to me would say they sought their remedy. You didn't push back and hopefully that book is closed. But also going to what you referred to about waiting 8 months after, you know, when you go for the relief that is typically sought for a non-compete or a non-solicit violation, you know, you're asking basically the court to step in immediately. Like I said, you kind of disregard these normal time frames. You usually are asking the court to step in immediately and put a stop to the conduct. And, you know, the way that you're able to get sort of that unusual relief is because you say, if you don't, I'm going to be unable to make this up. I will have lost the relationship. I will have lost the business. I would have lost my competitive edge. And so if a company knows about violations and waits and waits and waits, I mean, from the employee's perspective, it gives you a better argument. You really don't have anything to protect to begin with because you've waited this long. Mm-hmm. And it gives, you know, it puts
especially in our case, because we were playing nice. I mean, we weren't writing any business from that company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the other
thing. We were next door, but we weren't writing any business.
You're just standing in the parking lot as people pulled in. Anyway, the other thing I was going to say too is, you know, one reason I think a lot of employers are willing to delay besides the cost and the demands on the time of the employees to sort of prosecute one of those types of cases, you know, inevitably you're going to, if you follow through with the lawsuit past, you know, initial letter writing and demands, you know, you're going to end up getting your clients involved. And nobody really wants to do that because that's bad. I mean, that's just bad for everybody to have to bring your client in and say, why did you go to Scott instead of staying with me? I mean, that's not going to make your client a big fan.
Yeah. And let's talk about what the game is, right? The game is Bradley goes out on his own with no money. So we're going to sue him, even though it might be a little frivolous and we might not win, but we're going to sue him with our big, powerful lawyers. And he has no money to hire a big, powerful lawyer. You know, they don't know one of his best friends is a business attorney, but that's beside the point. And we're going to hope he just says, you know what, I'm going to throw my hands up. Screw this. We're not going to do this anymore. That's the game, right, Kim? Or that's part of the game is, hey, let's just suffocate you with legal and just slowly drain you out, right?
Well, as a lawyer, I hate to say that that's the game. But
it's definitely a strategy played by some.
Yeah, sure. Well, there's sort of, I think, three psychological pieces in play for this type of litigation. I mean, one is you're mad at the employee who left. They were valuable. You want to hurt them. And I think that is the scenario you are talking about, Bradley. And, you know, you have the resources to do that. One of the psychological things is you're scared that this is about to be everybody abandoning ship and the company is, maybe Bradley wasn't that valuable, but the company is going to take a hit if, you know,
they, you want to make an example.
Yeah. And that's the third is just, I have to do it on principle. If I had people sign it, I've got to act like I'm going to follow through. And so I'm on principle, I'm going to go after people. And usually I think it employers fall into one of those three categories. Mm-hmm. And the thing that usually happens, my partner would say the same thing, is, you know, they realize pretty quickly that the biggest winner in non-compete litigation is the lawyer, because a lot of money is made by the lawyer. And at the end of the day, I mean, even if you get that one employee to stop working, you know, it usually has been enough time that people, your clients have already moved on anyway, or they're going to wait around and jump as soon as that person opens up in 6 months or a year.
I'll tell you this too, Kim, 2 years for a good employee who makes a good impression on their clients, 2 years is not nearly enough time, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example, and this is not to pat myself on the back. I've been gone from my former employer for almost 2.5 years now. There was bad thunderstorms in South Alabama 2 nights ago, and a client from my former company that I have not talked to in at least 4 years called me. Knew I was gone, called me.
Yeah.
I don't think from, and it's from things that I've seen with other people too. I don't, because I don't think I'm that great of an agent, but I don't think that 2 years is nearly long enough. I'll tell you this too. I'm pro non-compete. I'll say that. We use them. Had somebody sign one today.
Boo.
I'm pro non-compete. I'm a big believer that non-competes are designed to protect your business against malice. They are not designed for you to control the lives of your former employees because your culture wasn't good enough to keep them. And well, I've seen cases of this where somebody just wants to screw with somebody just because their feelings are hurt that person left. And I get that and I appreciate that. But I'll give you an example. We had an employee that left here that went to go open their own agency. And the first thing somebody asked me, so are you going to go after them? I said, I'm not in the business of keeping somebody from chasing their dreams. I am in the business from keeping somebody from screwing me over. And if I start to get screwed over in the process, then that's when that happens. But as long as things are above board and done nicely, what's wrong with that person chasing their dreams? You know,
I'm anti non-compete. I think that, I have a hard time swallowing keeping someone from making a living. I find it beyond.
I agree.
I find it beyond comical that in the state of Alabama, the only two occupations that do not have non-competes. Kim's starting to laugh because she knows what I'm about to say. Attorneys and doctors. Why? Because they both run Montgomery in the state legislature.
There's somebody else that runs Montgomery, but we're not going to talk about that.
I think accountants and vets.
Oh, I'm sorry. And accountants and vets. Yeah. So I'm going to tell you why I have my people. And this is what I tell people when I hire them. I am not going to uphold your non-compete agreement. If you so choose to leave, you can go to work 5 miles down the road. Don't care. When I'm going to sue your ass and not stop is when our business starts walking out the door and I find out it's because you or somebody in the agency that you went to work for has started riding our business. That's when we're going to have a problem. But if you want to go 5-10 miles down the road, open up your thing and not call on our clients that are here at iProtect Insurance, I don't have a problem in the world with that. I really don't. But Kim, I do have one more contract question for you. One thing I've noticed in these carrier agreements with agents who are captive agents, especially, and this is something I wanted you to speak on, was they have that clause somewhere in the back of the contract that states, if any part of this contract is deemed to be null and void, that does not affect the other parts of this contract. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that clause is going to appear in just about every agreement you sign. What that is a contractual provision that recognizes what has been a long-standing practice of judges, which is called blue penciling. So, you know, you can strike one provision completely and keep everything else. And then blue penciling even goes so far as to say, you know, if you tried to restrain Scott from five states and that's too broad, I'll come in and say, you can't do five, but you can do one.
Right.
And so that is fairly standard, and that will be enforceable. If a court finds something in the agreement that doesn't work, it will ignore that provision, but it won't throw out everything else. And I mean, that makes sense. I mean, just in the most simplified sense, mm-hmm. I mean, that agreement right. may talk about what you're going to get paid, you know, right. and what your commissions are going to be. And you certainly wouldn't, as an agent, want that thrown out because they plugged in some non-compete provision that was too broad. Mm. So, I will mention too, though, there's a specific statute for commissions in Alabama that is pretty pro-employee.
What is that statute?
It's actually a sales commission statute. And I mean, it provides for attorney's fees. It provides for like treble damages, and so anyway, I am not studied up on that today, but I will tell you that that's just something I thought about popped into my head because Bradley mentioned something about commission. So if you're a commission based, you may want to talk with somebody and see if that applies to you and make sure before you just, you know, fold up your tent and assume there's nothing to be gained because you're leaving or whatever, you may want to give that some thought.
Well, I want to go back to Bradley's situation because I have a thought on that too, in terms of captive agents and even independent agents. What I have found to be the case is, and Bradley had this exact situation happen to him where he was owed money for a certain period of time. And what I have found to be the case is whether you're owed, let's say $50,000, maybe you had owned part of your book because you'd been there for a certain period of time or commissions after the fact were owed. What I have found to be the case is all of these carriers and agencies that do that in their contractual employment agreement, they will state that amount of money, whatever that is to be paid out over a certain period of time, typically 12 months, sometimes 24 months. But you know, for somebody that's owed $10,000, $20,000, that's one thing. And maybe you bite the bullet, maybe you roll the dice, and if they catch me doing something, they catch me, and then you get the letter that Bradley got. But I know guys that are contractually are supposed to get $500,000, $1 million. That, to me, that's a whole different ballgame. Then I think you do go to your garden and just work for
a hell yeah, you do. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I mean,
I was getting $600 a month. I wasn't worried about that.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to
Bradley's looking for that employer.
Yeah. Now, $600 a month when I started this scratch agency, like, that was a lot of money. It's still right. a lot of money, but I was like, yeah, all right, we'll sell one more policy.
Yeah, well, I talked to a guy last week that we were having a discussion about him coming on board with iProtect Insurance, and he's not in the state, but he is a captive agent. And we were through that discussion. He's like, well, I got to stay until this period of time. And I said, well, what's the deal there? And he said, well, if I stay until this date, I own a percentage of my book of business, and they're going to have to write me not a one-time check, but they're going to pay me out over a 12-month period, $550,000. And I thought, my God.
Go to truck driving school.
You better do something completely different than insurance when that's over. Because if you do decide to go somewhere else or open your own shingle, that would give them exactly what they need to be able to send you a letter and go, oh, you violated the agreement. Sorry, we can't pay you $550,000. Too bad.
Well, this is one thing, because I know we're coming up on the end, so I guess sort of like a little bit of my advice, because our hypotheticals now are kind of trending towards the, you know, what if you're looking to leave? What if you've got an opportunity? You know, I would say it is a poor decision to assume that you can just quietly sneak out and don't need to be worried about it. I think you need to be prepared for what the risk is before you leave, you know. So I wouldn't, certainly don't be communicating with your new or prospective employer on your work time, but I would suggest that you get counsel And sometimes if you've got an employer that's courting you, they will refer you to someone to have your agreement looked at. I've done that for people before, to just say, here's sort of the risk and here's your exposure. And you know, here's a little window where you could probably get away with working in this capacity in this place and not be in violation. But it's better to know that on the front end than just to think that you're going to, you know, move right down the road and be real quiet for a couple months and it'll, nothing will happen.
Well, I want to clarify too, on my situation. So Scott and I have a lot of agents reach out to us through the podcast. I would argue, Scott, that, and I would love to get your thoughts on this, the majority of the people that reach out to us are probably non-agency owners.
Yes.
And most of them are looking to be an agency owner, large percentage. I mean, I'm thinking like 80% or more.
Correct.
And you know, there have been some, more than probably I would like to admit, that are telling me kind of their strategy for leaving their agency or going independent or whatever. And it's in kind of a crappy way.
Yeah.
Like in a, I wouldn't do that kind of scenario. I want to be clear, like with my situation, and Kim said something that triggered my memory. Everything that I did was, the reason I got left alone was because I did everything as vanilla as I possibly could. Like literally, guys, like when I was planning Portal and putting my business plan together, I didn't do it during company time. It was after hours. I didn't even do it at the office. I would go to a coffee shop or go home. I talked to that many carrier reps before I take that back. I talked to one carrier rep the day I left because she called me.
Yep.
So things were done above board. There was none of this. That many lists were printed out. No lists were printed out. Like there was nothing, I don't know what the word is, but there was nothing of malice intent done. It was just like, hey, I'm going to chase this dream. I'm not going to screw you over in the process. Let's, you know, the only thing I did wrong is instead of putting in a 2 weeks, I cleaned my office out and said, hey, I'm gone. But I knew the policy for a salesperson who quits and puts in a 2 weeks is you fire him immediately. And I didn't want to be fired. So you've got to do this the right way in order to not get the crap suit out of you. You still might get the crap suit out of you, but it's not going to hurt you to try and do this the right way. And the thing is, if you have to sacrifice a little bit of business in the process, you're starting something that you're going to do for 30, 40, 50 years and is going to benefit your family for generations. Why can't you wait 2 years to write that $1,500 bop?
Well, and that's a really good point, Bradley, because, you know, our focus today has been on, you know, the non-compete agreement and what those look like in terms of enforcement. But you don't want to lose sight of the fact that there are all these things you can be doing on the side, like using your work computer to look at, to pursue other opportunities, or saving and downloading documents to places that your employer has not authorized you to save and download documents. And so you don't want to, in the process of trying to leave, create a claim that would not have otherwise been there.
I'll tell you something that did happen, though, that's interesting, and I was on the bad end of this. One downside to opening up an office next door to your old company is that the mailman is used to seeing your name and delivering that mail next door. So I actually had mail at Portal get delivered to my competitor. So that was an interesting conversation. Hey, I need that back. I got a check you got. I need that back.
Hey, Kim, I got one more question for you before we go, and I know we're up against the time. I want you to speak to all these agents out there that work with their family, that work for an older independent agent. They've been working there for 8 or 9 years. They've been promised that one day they are going to be handed the keys to the kingdom and they are going to be the agency owner, but they have nothing in writing. What happens when that 7-year-old agency owner walks in one day and says, "Great news, guys. We just sold out to Hub International for $37 million. And he's high-fiving everybody, and you're standing there going, what? I thought you were selling this to me. Am I correct? If it ain't in writing, you ain't got shit? I mean, is that pretty much where we are?
Yeah, there are big categories of things that are required to be in writing. And, you know, those are all set out in the statute. But, you know, if you're not going to do something in the next year, you're supposed to put it in writing. If it's the sale of property, it's supposed to be in writing. If it's something over a certain value, it's supposed to be in writing. But, I mean, I think, Scott, just going with good old, you don't even need a lawyer, good old common sense. If you are counting on, you know, something as big as the business being sold over to you, you don't want to have that just be a chit chat over coffee. I mean, even if it wasn't with any malice, I mean, that person gets in the car and has a wreck and then it's gone and it, you know, it's going to his family in the will instead of to you like it was planned.
Right.
So, you know, I would say link up with a corporate lawyer and have somebody sort of memorialize what the plan is, even if it's not time to facilitate that right then.
Well, the reason he's asking that is we get that a lot too. A lot. Hey, I'm at this agency. I've been promised ownership. Is right. it in writing? 60% of the time it's not. And the few that I've had that I've told, hey, you need to go talk to this owner. You, if you don't have it in writing, you don't have anything. And because, you know, Hub comes in or whoever, Hilb comes in and offers them 3x earnings and you're done. I mean, I know of a case right now that the person probably doesn't know that I know of that's going to get absolutely screwed over in the process and is holding out hope that they get ownership to this agency and it ain't going to happen. And you've got to get it in writing. And in some of the cases, like I've not pressured, but encouraged people to go talk to that agency owner and get it in writing and it hasn't gone well, you know?
Well, that right there, Bradley, what you just ended that with, that's when you know it's time to leave.
Yeah.
Is when you do walk into that principal's office who for the last 8, 9, 10 years has been saying, man, one day this is all going to be yours. This is all going to be yours. Mm-hmm. And you're like, hey, I had my attorney draw this up. Here you go. And then they start getting defensive and I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not signing it. Well, then you know, right? Yeah. It's almost like by doing that, then you can – settle it with yourself that, okay, this guy's not going
to
do it.
Time to move on.
Yeah, it's time to move on.
Hey, this is a real thing. This was not staged, but I just got a package here.
Oh, boy.
While we've been on this call from our friends at Glovebox. I swear to goodness, this is not. So I'm going to open it on the air. I have no idea what it is. And I'm assuming it's T-shirts and stuff, but we'll see.
Kim, do you have any other advice for these insurance agents in the most litigious?
No.
Thing in the world is insurance, you know, non-competes, employment agreements, ownership agreements. I mean, these people keep you. I can't even imagine how many calls you get a month from a year from the insurance people in the insurance industry. I'm sure it's quite a bit.
Well, I would just say tune into this podcast. You guys are the most entertaining thing I've had in a long time.
Brad, I'm over here opening presents. Sorry.
Yeah, Bradley's opening presents while I'm trying to
wrap Kim's, it up.
Kim's billing up
it. Dude, like David Letterman style, we need to have these glove box Turbis tumblers sitting on the table when we, you know.
That's awesome. Hey, Kim, before we go,
yeah.
Thank you, glove box, for sending us some swaggy swag. Hey, tell our audience how they can get in touch with you if they do have employment or non-compete questions and want to talk to you about any of that.
Yeah. So our law firm is Scott, S-C-O-T-T, Dukes, like Dukes of Hazzard, and Geisler. That's my last name, G-E-I-S-L-E-R. And my direct dial is 205-244-2505. But a Google search will get you to the website, and you can choose from any one of our many wonderful lawyers. Most all of us have some experience in non-compete and day-to-day employment advice.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show
today. Enjoyed it.
I'm sure I'll be calling you next week or the week after for something.
Scott has such a like almost like negative viewpoint when he hires an employee. Every time he hires somebody, he just assumes he's going to be sued from the
start. It's going to happen.
And guess what? It's not going to get any worse than that. So if you're pleasantly surprised, everybody's in a good mood, you know?
Yeah. So I think there's supposed to be some disclaimer that goes across the bottom of the thing that, like, you know, the quality of legal services are not better than anybody else's legal services. No promises are made about representations. I advise you to talk to your own lawyer. I'm not giving anybody any specific legal advice. All appropriate disclaimers.
There you go. Guys, you heard the disclaimers. Thank you so much for being here. Guys, as I end every show, rewards come from action, not discussion. Get your ass out from behind that desk today. go hire a good labor attorney to help you with all your non-competes, employment agreements, and that principal agent that told you you're getting 30% of the agency 5 years from now, and make money for your family, for your wife, for your husband, for your kids' college fund, and your parents that are struggling out there. Go write good business for the agencies that you represent, and go write good business for the companies that you represent. Bradley Flowers, I love you.
Thanks, man. Thanks, Kim.
Hi, y'all. Thank you so much.
We love you, Kim.
Thank you. Oh, I love y'all, too. I had the best time.
Bye. All right, see you later. Hey, guys, you are listening to the Insurance Guys Podcast. We love you, too, and we'll see you back here real soon. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Insurance Guys Podcast. If you need to know more about me or you need to get in touch with Scott, you can always reach me at theinsuranceguyonline.com or email me at iprotectins@gmail.com. And if you need to get in touch with Mr. Bradley Flowers, go to bradleyflowersinsurance.com or email him at bradley@saralandinsurance.com. Guys, we love you. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to being with you again real soon on the next episode of the Insurance Guys. Take care.